Hi, everyone. Today's pensée is on the topic of woke. I'm assuming that everyone has heard this term in some context or other, but I suspect very few people know where the idea of woke comes from. After listening to today's episode, I think you'll find that you'll be able to define at least the basic conception of woke and explain how the word functions for those who claim the term. Like many words, it has a history that's somewhat complicated, not least by the fact that those who dislike woke see it as pernicious. In other words, the term is used by both those who claim it for themselves and those who attack others who style themselves or claim to be woke. You probably don't need me to tell you that the two sides have very different ideas about the word and what it means. So let's start with trying to just get to the bottom of this. While I've read a number of things about woke, let me particularly recommend A History of Wokeness by Asia Romano that appeared on Vox on October 9 of 2020. Romano begins with the fact that this term is, for most people, relatively new. In 2014, Michael Brown was killed by the police, and the newly formed Black Lives Matter movement started using the term woke. In short, those involved in the movement pushed for staying woke in response to the actions of the police and others. By the way, the movement was founded by three black women, two of whom are also queer, and thus queer voices have been part of BLM from the beginning. Romano claims that to be woke is to be, and I'm quoting from her, a staunch social justice advocate who's abreast of contemporary political concerns. That's the view of those who use the term positively. Those who use it negatively think that it's something like political correctness. But once you learn what the word denotes, you probably think that it's actually a good idea, at least in its most basic form. Marcus Garvey, a Jamaican social activist who is truly an interesting figure, used the phrase, "Wake up, Ethiopia! Wake up, Africa!" back in 1923. Garvey was calling for black people everywhere to be more attentive to their own political and social situations, with the idea that only such attentiveness could lead to change. Let me point out that already with this idea of staying woke, there is a kind of implicit threat to the established social order. We live in a time in which the social order is being revised and rethought. If you are down and out, the phrase will likely sound positive to you. If you're a member of the 1%, you may be uneasy hearing people call for change, because that change just might affect you. The term gets picked up by the blues musician Huddy Ledbetter, who is perhaps better known as Leadbelly. His song Scottsboro Boys, composed in 1938, focuses on an event that happened in 1931. Namely, there were nine black teenagers living in Scottsboro, Arkansas, who were accused of raping two white women. I'm not going to go into detail here, but if you read up on the event, you'll see that it was a particularly brutal instance of injustice and racism. That's why Leadbelly warns his listeners that if they're traveling to Arkansas, and now I'm quoting, "The man gonna get ya." And then in a spoken afterword to the recording, he admonishes travelers, stay woke. He says, again I'm quoting, "I advise everybody, be a little careful when they go along through there. Best stay woke, keep their eyes open." In 1962, a piece appeared in the New York Times by the black novelist William Melvin Kelly titled, "If You're Woke, You Dig It." Kelly talks about the ways in which black people's speech is appropriated by white people. He's particularly responding to those who self-describe as beatniks and think they're cool. But Kelly insists that the language they're using comes from the black idiom. He specifically mentions words like cat, often modified with cool, as in cool cat, the use of the verb to dig as denoting liking something, adding ville to the end of a word. He uses the example of a headache, and he refers to the situation as illsville, and explains that like functions as verbal punctuation. I was particularly interested in this last one, since the using of like in American speech has probably become much more common since this piece was written, and I've long wondered why. He talks about white people using hip language, and quotes someone as saying, "Man, they just blew the gig by being gray." Just to be clear, gray is a term used for white people. Deandra Miles Hercules, a doctoral student in linguistics, says that Kelly's description suggests that to be woke is to have a native relationship to black language, culture, and knowledge of social issues that arise in our lived experience. In effect, then, if people weren't following Lead Belly and didn't know about Marcus Garvey, then this 1962 article would be their first introduction to woke. And it also gives one some context. Kelly points out that black Americans have long used different language so that they could talk without white people understanding. As he puts it, if your master did not know what you were talking about, he could not punish you, and you could maintain your ignorance and innocence. But if the reason for using different language was to maintain secrecy, it only stands to reason that it would take a while for such words to work themselves into general culture. Indeed, Kelly makes the point that once white people start using these words, black people invent new words or take old ones and give them their opposite meaning. That would explain, for instance, how the word sick is used positively as a compliment, or an entirely new meaning. Romano claims that the term woke in black communities now has three meanings. One is simply a slang way of saying that one is awake in a literal sense. Another is being suspicious of a cheating romantic partner. The third use is the one we've been discussing, which is, of course, being alert to systemic injustice. Georgia Ann Muldrow wrote a song titled Master Teacher, with the refrain being, "I'd stay woke." Erykah Badu made a recording of the song, though she changed the refrain to, "I stay woke." Here are some lines from that song. "Even if your baby ain't got no money, to support your baby, I stay woke. Even when the preacher tells you some lies and cheating on your mama, you stay woke. Even though you go through struggle and strife to keep a healthy life, I stay woke. I have longed to stay awake. A beautiful world I'm trying to find." I think those lines capture the hope of trying to stay alert and understand the situation in which one finds oneself. Romana points out that what happened in Ferguson was, and here I'm quoting from her, a true social awakening for many activists and progressives. She claims that the hashtag Stay Woke, and now again I'm quoting from her, allowed black citizens to unite around a shared perception and experience of reality, and to galvanize themselves and each other for a very long fight for change. In 2016, a documentary appeared with the title Stay Woke, the Black Lives Matter Movement. Then the next year, 2017, Jordan Peele's horror film Get Out was released, and its protagonist Chris needs to constantly stay woke to the racism he experiences when he visits his white girlfriend's house. The film employs the Childish Gambino song Redbone, which has the refrain of stay woke. I'm not going to quote the lyrics of the song, but they're well worth hearing or reading. Peele says that he chose the song because of its use of the refrain stay woke, which, as he puts it, is what the movie is about. Of course, the problem now is that some people use this word as some kind of slur. Romano quotes Karen Swallow Pryor, who used to be a professor at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and before that, a professor at Liberty University. She says, "In my conservative Southern Baptist community, the term has become an insult that is used against anyone who's concerned about justice and racism. They use the word like a weapon." And here I think is where things start to get interesting. Growing up in the evangelical world, I was astonishingly asleep. Alas, I think that's exactly what I was supposed to be. Among the many things I've done to combat this is to have served as an editor for series with Erdmans designed to showcase the thinking of various people who were in one way or another, were writing about theology in new and different ways, ways in which their own background became catalysts for rethinking theology. The first book in the series was titled Prophetic Evangelicals, Envisioning a Just and Peaceful Kingdom. It included a wide range of authors doing theology from their own distinctive perspectives. Unfortunately, I saw a review of it in Christianity Today that dismissed the book as being too progressive. I'd love to tell you that now everything has changed, but Pryor is right. If you start talking about social justice in the evangelical world, people become nervous. But there's a further problem. Romano writes that many people across the ideological spectrum seem wary of the performative semantics associated with wokeness and the way that performance can undermine the sincerity of arguments being made in support of equality. She quotes Chloe S. Valdery as saying that, "I always saw the use of the term as a tad performative. I think it's mostly performative and at best tells me nothing about a person's ideas regarding social justice. It feels like a status-seeking label as opposed to a mode of being that is seeking positive change." Unfortunately, there's much truth in that statement. People often use moral-sounding language to make them seem more righteous. But of course, that's true on both the left and the right, or however you want to slice up the world of ideas. Pryor also found this to be a problem. But what most worries Pryor is the way conservative people now use the term. She says, "I have had private conversations with pastors who have used it as a term of insult," and then goes on to say that it is hurtful to use a term that is so meaningful to people and use it in an entirely different way. It's simply wrong. I hope you didn't miss the irony of her statement, given what Kelly says about the black idiom constantly changing, indeed sometimes by reversing the meaning of a term. Now, in addition to this, Miles Hercules points out that the word, and now I'm quoting, has been commodified in marketing to connote a host of associations to things like diversity, inclusion, and so on, in order to turn a profit by appealing to progressive sensibilities. Additionally, it has been plundered into conservative and right-wing discourse as a means of mocking and satirizing the politics of those on the other side of the proverbial aisle. Indeed, the writer James Lindsay has claimed that wokeness is, in effect, a religion where faith in social justice ideology stands in for belief in a deity, and protests are like church services. I find that a little hard to believe, but it's worth thinking about. As I've argued, people are inherently religious in the sense that they have something sacred that binds them together with like-minded folk. They think they're not religious because they don't associate with any of the things that we usually call religions. Jamar Tisby, whom Romano quotes, makes an interesting and appropriate biblical reference. Jesus said, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven." Not everyone who says woke, woke is actually committed to racial justice. I think that's a really interesting statement. Here's what Pryor says about herself. "The solution I've arrived at when somebody uses a term like that as an insult is to ignore the insult and respond to what might underlie the insult, the bigger concern. Because the polarization is only going to be defeated by transcending the binary categories of the argument." We've talked before on the podcast about binaries, particularly when we spoke with Liz Edmond. Liz pointed out that Jesus was constantly disrupting binaries. For instance, the Jews and the Samaritans intensely disliked each other. But Jesus has no problem talking to a Samaritan woman, which, in case you didn't notice, meant that he was also disrupting the male-female binary. But this is truly a challenge. I invited Cornel West to give a talk at Wheaton. The room was packed, and many, many people sent me emails thanking me for inviting him. But I also got another email, one from an older white person, who started out by asking why I had invited West, and eventually led to simply denigrating me as a person. I'm pleased to say that I don't have that email anymore, so I can't give you any specifics. However, what seemed to be the problem was that West had, not exactly surprisingly, talked about racism. From my perspective, he did this in a very gentle way, and clearly understood the audience very well. In other words, there wasn't really anything about his presentation that was offensive. And that led me to think that the real problem was that West was saying something that this person just didn't want to hear. Perhaps the listener didn't think that what West was saying was correct. But I think it's much more likely that the offense came precisely because he realized that West was correct. West was saying something disturbing and also true. When Jesus would say something particularly controversial, he often added the phrase, "He who has ears to hear." Doesn't that sound like what it means to be woke in its most basic meaning? Jesus talks to his disciples about those who hear but don't understand. Aren't such people precisely the opposite of woke? If they're not, then I don't know how else to describe them. Remember, woke, in its most basic sense, is simply being alert, having one's eyes and ears open. One would think that followers of Jesus would be people who want their ears and eyes to be open. But as we've seen, the problem is that once you open your eyes and ears, you realize you might actually have to live differently. That's all for today. I'm Dr. Bruce Ellis Benson. Thanks for joining us.